We're looking forward to this time together and our study in the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 2 this morning. We have given somewhat of an introduction to this book. Remember that John is on the isle called Patmos for the Word of God and for his testimony of Jesus Christ. And while there, the Lord has given him this revelation of Jesus Christ. And we pointed out in chapter 1 that basically there is a three-point outline to this book. The things that he's seen, the things that are, and the things that shall be hereafter. We have dealt with the things that he's seen, and we're dealing with the things that are. That will take us through chapter 3, the end of chapter 3. Dealing with the seven churches and the letters that are written to the seven churches. And then afterwards we find the things that shall be hereafter. And I think it's an interesting study. The churches that we're looking at now, seven churches in Asia. Keep in mind this is not all of the churches that were in existence in Asia, but seven are chosen as that number of completion and perfection. And of these seven, then the Lord would show us the things that he wants us to know with regard to the church. And each church is receiving a message through their angel or through their pastor. We looked at the message to the church in Ephesus last week, and that took us from verse 1 in chapter 2 through verse 7. We want to read verses 8 through 11, and we'll just see this morning whether we have time to deal with two churches. We may want to deal with Pergamos if we have time. But the next church in line is Smyrna, beginning with verse 8 and through verse 11. It's a very brief message in one sense of the word, but yet it is a thorough and deep message that is given to this particular church that we know as the church in Smyrna. So let's read these verses from verse 8 on through verse 11. And then we will look at some things I think of interest in this particular section. And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. This church, you'll notice, is a church that the Lord will not have any condemnation of, only commendation. This is a church that actually is a church of tribulation and persecution and even death. The name of the city itself, I think, was chosen significantly by the Spirit of God so that we'd see something of interest here. The city of Smyrna actually is a city where the perfume or the fragrance myrrh was brought in. The name itself actually signifies that. And myrrh in the Bible is associated with death. The first time we find it mentioned was when the wise men came from the east and they brought their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The gold speaks of our Lord's deity. The frankincense speaks of his fragrance and his intercessory work. And the myrrh speaks of his death. Other places that you find this term used, in his death they wrapped him in the garment, the shroud, and it was sealed with the myrrh. So the name then gives us some key to this church and the intent of the Spirit of God to portray this church to us and some things that we'll want to notice about it. First, again, we'll notice that the message is unto the angel of the church, and then he introduces himself. Now, each time the Lord will introduce himself to a particular church, he will use a varied representation of what has been said by John in the first chapter. And in this particular case, he is saying, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. And so this church is going to have a message that they're going to need to know, that he was here before all of this started, and he'll be here when it's all done. Because they're going to face some tribulation, that they'll need to know that there's one that will outlast the tribulation and the persecution that's going to be in their life. And so he speaks from that vantage point to them. And since they are facing imminent martyrdom in this particular city, which was quite likely, and one was martyred there, and we'll mention him in a moment. The one who has conquered death for us, who was dead and is alive, is speaking. And so as he presents himself, then he introduces then the subject of his message to them and said, I know thy works and tribulation and poverty. There's three things that he will note about them. And then he'll point out that he knows the blaspheming of them who say they're Jews and are not. But first of all, we notice again that he points out that he knows. Yes, this is a theme that runs throughout these seven churches that we need to keep in mind. The Lord knows. I don't know why we get it in our mind that we can hide anything from God, but we sometimes get to thinking that we can hide something from God, but he always knows. He's not hidden from the heart and mind of God. So in this particular case, he said, I know, and he said, I know thy works. In other words, again, he knows, as he did the church in Ephesus, he knows the quality of those works. He knows the intent behind those works. He knows all about them. He knows the quantity of the works, so forth. In other words, he's able to discern all that there is to know about their works. And so there's nothing that's hidden from them, but he speaks in commendation of their works. He's satisfied with their works. Remember the church at Ephesus, he points out they had left their first love. It was not the type of works that they were doing, but it was the motive behind the works, by and large, that there was their problem. But here, the motivation is still the love of the Lord. And certainly the persecution that this church is facing and is going through would have kept them true to that. I mean, else we would have fallen by the wayside. You know, when love wanes, you want to cease to suffer for that thing or that person that you love, if that love waned. And in this case, their love had not waned for the Lord. They had continued in the works. But then he points out some things here and speaks, I think, of things interesting. He said, I know thy tribulation. Now, this word tribulation, in this particular instance, speaks of a pressure that is upon them. We think of tribulation sometimes, and we go through it for a time, and it ends. But in the city of Smyrna, the idea of this tribulation here with the pressure is that it will be a pressure, and it's a continued pressure. You know, it's one thing to have pain momentarily, and it's another thing to have pain persistently and consistently, or to have that pressure upon you. And here the Lord is saying to them, I know your tribulation. In other words, I know that this is not something that is just sporadic, that is momentary, but this is something that is a continuing pressure upon you. You know, sometimes we are thrown into a circumstance in our life where we're put under pressure. And it's something that we have all during the day. We go to bed with it at night. We wake up with it in the morning. And it wears away at us. Well, this particular church, they were consistently, persistently under pressure. Now, there's reason for that. Let me draw you a picture of this city so that we can appreciate maybe the pressure that is upon them. First of all, religion was a very popular thing in the city of Smyrna. Smyrna was a city that actually the history of it just goes back into antiquity. It's just, there's seemingly from a historical standpoint, there was always a city in this location. As it was taken by the Greeks, then it became a city of great culture and a center of religion, if you please. And so there were just in splendid fashion temples that were built here. You have to know a little bit about the Greek culture and and the worship, the religion of the Greeks, when you know that and you see that, you'd understand that here was a city that, being a wealthy city, they put everything forth in great splendor. I mean, you would go down a street and there would be temple after temple built to their particular deities. And they would stand out, certainly. And even here there was the great temple built to Zeus, the chief god of the Greeks. And so it was a city that had a lot of religion in it. That would have certainly put pressure upon this little quaint church that would, from our vantage point today, would have been on the wrong side of the track. This church would have not been a wealthy church. In fact, he speaks of their poverty. I'll deal with that in a moment. But we find there was that center of worship of the Greek gods, and later, of course, incorporated into the Roman culture, which were nonetheless the same gods, just had a different name. But as time had progressed in under the auspices of the Roman Empire, the first emperors of Rome fought against being recognized as deity. But that there might be a unifying effort and a bond that would bind the Roman Empire together, there was sought a common ground for attachment and worship. And first of all, it was placed upon the spirit of Rome, but this became personified then in the Caesars and the emperors, and emperor worship came into being, and ultimately it would reach a fine height as the emperors themselves gave way to that desire, and they would demand worship. Now, this was actually the case in John's day under Domitian, that he was exiled under great persecution because the Christians would not worship the emperor. All the citizen had to do was to take just a small pinch of incense, go to the temple that was built to Caesar, offer that incense and say, "Caesar's Lord," and then they could go worship anywhere else they wanted to without any hint of persecution. But the believer, the Christian, knowing that Jesus Christ is Lord, would never go into that place and offer that pinch of incense and say that Caesar is Lord. Consequently, there would be persecution because this, again, was the effort to unify Rome and to keep it bound together in strength. And this church here, of course, would not do that, and they would then become ostracized because of their, what they would be termed, traitors of the empire and things of that nature. And so there would be a constant pressure upon them, never knowing when there might be then that group that would come, or that one that would come and break down the door and take them. Let me make reference to one that was here. There was a fellow named Polycarp. He's a figure of history, a disciple of John the Apostle, the one that is writing this book. Remember, John pastored over at Ephesus, and Polycarp pastors here in Smyrna. There came a time under persecution whenever he was told to plead allegiance to Caesar, and he would not. And they approached him, if I remember correctly, the story three times. Each time they would tell him to blaspheme the name of Jesus, to plead allegiance and pledge allegiance then to Caesar. He finally said to the effect, he said, 86 years I've served him. He's never done me wrong. He said, why would I deny him now? And through the day they persisted. Two more times they approached Polycarp, and each time they said no. They threatened him with the lions, and the beast had no fear for him. They finally threatened him with fire. And he told them, "You can light the torch." He said, "I'll not deny it." And as they burned him in the fire, he was heard to pray to the effect that, "God, I thank you that I've been chosen to suffer for your great name." And so he died then, the martyr's death, in the city of Smyrna, because he would not bow the knee to Caesar. And so we see then the pressure that was upon this church. And Jesus said, "I know the pressure that is on you. I know your tribulation." And the thing about it is that it was a tribulation that would continue. The Lord warns them, and you'll have more of the same. We'll look at that in just a moment as we look through this church. You have the pressure now, and you'll have the pressure, and you'll continue to have the pressure. Lord, this is not something that will be removed from you, but the Lord knows it. And that should be a comfort to us, to know that the Lord knows those things that come our way. You know, Job went through a great trial, a great tribulation in his life. There came an end to his tribulation. Whenever he prayed for his friend, the Bible said the Lord turned his tribulation and blessed him. But here the idea presented to this church is, I know your tribulation. And in other words, it is something that is to continue. It'll not be turned around. They're in the midst of a place that there is a witness and a need of a witness of the Lord. But it's not something that will soon be over. And he said, I know your tribulation. And he said, I know your poverty. There are two ideas of poverty, really, that the Greeks would have presented. One was that you live somewhat in an impoverished state. You know, some of us talk about living hand to mouth. That's poverty in one sense of the word. But then there was another idea of poverty that would be presented with the Greek thinking. That was absolute, total deprivation and impoverishment, that they had lost everything. And that's the idea of this church in Smyrna. They have absolutely lost everything. Again, we have to understand something of the culture of the day. We have all of the gods and the goddesses, the temples. But in that day also, every craft had a guild. They would be much akin to our modern-day labor union. The labor unions are not as religious, but sometimes they almost demand allegiance just as strongly as religion does. And so this is not a treatise against labor unions. I have my opinion of labor unions and their place, and I'll leave it at that. But the guilds always were intertwined with religion. And a believer, as a person was born again, became a Christian, certainly would not enter into that false worship that was associated with his particular trade guild. Consequently, he would be ostracized from his trade, and nobody would hire him. And here these people are literally impoverished because of their stand for Jesus Christ. It cost them dearly to serve the Lord. Now, you'll notice these things that are said. I know your works. I know the tribulation, the pressure that is upon you. I know your great poverty. I know that you absolutely are impoverished. It's not just that you go out and live hand to mouth, but literally they are impoverished. They were as beggars, cast out into a merciless society. And Jesus said, I know that. But then you'll notice the parenthesis, but thou art rich. Thou art rich. Now, that's a strange thing. This is a message that I developed some time ago, and I've been several years ago now and preached about the things the church ought to know. And the title of that message was, The Church Needs to Know What True Riches Are. Now here this church is in the midst of wealth and grandeur and pleasures. And some would say that's wealth. That's desirable. That's what we ought to have. But Jesus said, but thou art rich. I mean, here's an impoverished church from a worldly standpoint. They just absolutely were at the depths of the poverty level. And yet he said, you're rich. Now, there are reasons why they're rich. First of all, just to know Christ is great riches. You know, we take for granted a lot of things today. We that have grown up, even though we might not have been active in church, we grew up around Christian influence, and we've understood something of Christ all of our lives, even though we were saved at a later age. We've taken for granted a lot of things that we ought to count very near and dear and precious to us as a great riches. That's just to know Christ. We sometimes lose sight of the fact that there are people this morning in this world that will absolutely not have any opportunity to hear the word preached because it's not allowed in their land. There are countries in existence today that men will be put to death if they convert to Christianity. So the Lord is saying to this church, but thou art rich. And understand this morning that we're rich if we know Jesus Christ. as this church in Smyrna knew Jesus Christ. Secondly, I believe they're rich in that they have the influence and direction of God in their lives. It's great riches to be guided of God, to be on the right track. It's sometimes appalling to me to see people take good life and absolutely throw it away. I mean, to take life as it is, a gift of God, and waste it, literally waste it. I cannot help but think of a relative of mine. He died at the age of 35. He died an alcoholic and a dope addict. And his life was wasted. Literally wasted. When we went to the funeral, he didn't have enough friends left to carry him to his grave. And I could not help but be touched by that, with the thought, this is tragic. It's loss, great loss. And it's riches this morning to have God as the navigator of our life, if you please, as the director of our lives, that we might know the true riches of living itself, and not live a wasted life and look back on it with nothing but regret. And so this church at Smyrna, in that sense, is rich. And then, of course, they're rich in that beyond this life, I mean, beyond this veil of tears, there is a place prepared for the saints of God. And Jesus is saying to this church, this is not all. You're rich. Those folks who are living in their splendor are impoverished. But he said, you're rich. Even though I know your poverty, your absolute destitution, I know all about you, but you're rich. And so this church in Smyrna had some things that the Lord would say are for you, and you're rich. That could be developed even farther if we had time this morning. But he said, I know the blaspheme of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. The idea that is presented here is that because of other influences, there were those that were Jewish in name. I mean, some even were akin to the Caesars. They would marry into that, or there would be those that would become proselytes to Judaism that would be close to the emperor. In fact, if I remember correctly, one of the emperors would even married to a woman that became a proselyte to Judaism. And the Lord is saying that there are those that say they're Jews, but they're not, because they are the authors of great persecution. Just like any other lost person, a Jew without Christ is just as prone to selfish interests as anyone else. And in the city of Smyrna, because there was great wealth there, and there were Jewish people that moved in those circles, they would influence then persecution of that little Christian church. And Jesus said, I know those that blaspheme. They say they're Jews, but they're not. He said they're the synagogue of Satan, because they would cause to be raised against this little church great persecution and even bring about death. And so we find that this church is known to the Lord, and he said some things about them. But then there are the words of encouragement that we find for this church. He said, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Well, we have to go back again to what he said, I'm the first and the last, if we're going to appreciate this. Understand that in your life, whatever comes your way, when it started, Jesus Christ was there. And whatever it brings to pass in the process, he said, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. And when it comes down to the end of it, he'll still be there. I'm the first and the last. And this church in Smyrna were encouraged by the thought that there was an ever-present Christ, in spite of all that they would suffer. It's not any wonder when we look back at the martyrs, as they would literally be burned at the stake or whatever fashion of death was devised for them. I remember reading the testimony of one in their great persecution to encourage those that would soon meet the same fate from the flames. He said, it's not so bad. How could he say that? Because he knew that Christ was there when it started, and he knew that Christ would be there when it was over. And he'd be with him in between. And so he said to this church to encourage them, I'm the first and the last. He's the beginning of our trial, and he'll be at the end of the trial. He said, I'm he that was dead, and am alive. He's conquered death. These were facing death. This church in Smyrna, Polycarp the pastor was martyred. And there have been others that are unnamed to us. You see, we don't have the whole record. We just have bits and pieces that are presented to us. In the next church in Pergamos, there'll be another that is martyred. And we have those records that are available to us. Polycarp's record comes down through even secular history to us, this man and the testimony that he held. But these people in Smyrna faced imminent death. And yet the one who had conquered death stood by them and said, fear none of these things which thou shalt suffer. And then he points out their fate. He said, behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days, or an extended intense persecution. The idea of the 10 and the number signifies the intensity, that it'll be severe persecution that will be upon them. But he said, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Now, there are certain crowns that are won. And in this particular case, I believe this is the crown that is won by the martyr, the crown of life. They're faithful unto death. Now, that does not mean that there'd be some who live faithfully that would not be willing to die. But for those in this particular case, if you just be faithful unto death, I'll give you the crown of life. In other words, this is the end of this and the riches that will be bestowed upon you. There is an end. They're admonished to be faithful, to just persistently stay with what they have been doing. And then he said, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the church. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now, death may come in the first instance, but there is no fear of the second death. Now, John will deal with this subject of the second death later on in this book, as he draws very graphically the picture of that great white throne and the one who sits upon that throne. And there is the fleeing away of the heavens and the earth from the face of the one that sits on that throne. An awesome sight is described for us whenever that judgment is set. He then very pointedly points out that the books are open and the dead are raised to stand at the judgment, and they are judged out of the things that are written in the books. And then at the end of that judgment, the Bible said that those whose names were not found written in the book of life were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. Here Jesus is saying to this church in Smyrna, you don't have to fear, because as you're faithful unto death, the power of the second death has no hold upon you. In other words, you'll not be cast into that lake of fire, but rather you'll be ushered into the presence of the Lord. And I would like to think it'd be much like the scene that we saw at Stephen's death, his martyrdom. Here the crowd are so angry that they take Stephen, the one who's the evangelist, the one that has preached one of the most powerful messages you'd read in the Word of God, to a nation of people, the representative of the leaders of that nation, and they rise up. And the Bible said they gnashed on him. I mean, they were so angry that they would literally want to bite him. They cast him outside the city and they stoned him to death. But the Bible said that Stephen saw Jesus. He saw him and he said, I see Jesus, the right hand of the Father. And this must have incited the people even into greater anger. But Stephen no longer felt the pain of the blows that from the stones that were cast at him and upon him, because he beheld Jesus. And I am persuaded the same picture is here for this church in Smyrna. Just nothing to look forward to but poverty and continued poverty, pressure and continued pressure. But all as it comes to the consummation and it comes to the end, whether it be through the martyr's death or even natural death, there awaits the one who loved us with an everlasting love, none other than Jesus Christ, to usher us into the very presence of the Father. and they're to be known as his sons, his daughters, forever and forever. The city of Smyrna and the church in Smyrna, a very interesting church to me. I think a church that is worthy of some attention and study because it stood faithful in the face of all that went on. I mean, it would have been very easy for this church to compromise. As much as it is today, we want to do what's right. But sometimes when a church does not progress, does not grow, we always want them to turn to the antics of the world. You know, there was something disturbing to me some years ago that came out of the leading televangelists. The majority of them, if not all of them, had gone to the agencies of New York and had learned how to be successful in the world. What would make them popular? Well, whether we're popular or not is beside the point. Are we doing God's will? Are we carrying on God's work? And I'm not sure that the Lord will say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," if we use the tactics of the world. But here's this little church in the midst of great wealth, impoverished. It had been rather easy sometimes to have said, "Well, let's compromise just a little bit. That we might have a little better building. We might have a little bit more comfort." But no, they stood their ground. They held to their testimony of the saving grace of Jesus Christ, would not compromise, would not take their pinch of incense and go to Caesar's temple and say, "Caesar's Lord." They said, "No, Jesus is Lord. And He's worthy. And we'll stand our ground and we'll not compromise and we'll not yield."